This week's editorial, Democratic Process by Lisa Loomis. With the resignation of Heidi Speer, one of the two Faison representatives on the Harwood Unified Union School District Board, comes the need to find a replacement. State education law prior to Act 46 and the creation of Unified Union School Districts such as ours, 16 VSA 7061, Bullet 2 says, quote, "If a member represented a town that does not have a school board, the clerk shall immediately notify the select board of the town. Within 30 days of the receipt of that notice, the select board shall appoint a person who is otherwise eligible to serve as a director from that district to fill the vacancy until an election at a special or annual district meeting is held." But that statute applies to union schools and school districts and joint schools. The HUUSD is none of those things. It is a unified school district under the terms of Vermont's Act 46, and its articles of association do not speak to vacancies, but do require that, quote, "the board be made up of 14 individuals elected by Australian ballot by the voters of the municipalities in which they reside." There are also existing education laws that require a school board to fill its own vacancy, as used to happen when we had individual town school boards. But we don't have individual school boards anymore. We have a combined board. The question is, who should elect an individual town's reps to our big board? Should those who want to replace Speer as Faison's rep to the big board be vetted and selected by the reps from the other towns or by their own townspeople? According to the Vermont Secretary of State's office, the law does provide that when a board member was elected to an open, sworn position by voters of only one town, then that town could petition the unified board to replace that member via a sworn town vote. The petition would need signatures from 5% of registered voters. It's not completely clear legally how to interpret statutes that are written without regard for unified union districts and the disparate language that Vermont's unified union district used to incorporate. There are still many unknowns as we work with our newly unified union school district, given that we have a way to let the voters of a town select their representatives via petition for a town election versus unified board selection. When vacancies arise, perhaps we should err on the side of the most representative democracy as possible by encouraging interested townspeople to petition for the right to elect their own representative. More Mold Found in School Kitchen, Another Flood, Another Week at Sugarbush, by Lisa Loomis. Warren Elementary School students, staff, and administrators spent a second week at Sugarbush Resort after more mold was found in the kitchen and other pockets of the school. Additionally, a hot water heater in the kitchen failed and sent 150 gallons of water into the art room in the basement. Work was already underway to abate black mold that was discovered in the aftermath of a September 3rd roof failure that flooded the school. While work was being done to check for flood damage, pre-existing black mold was found and asbestos was disturbed. The plan is now for students and staff to return to the school on Monday, September 25th, according to Superintendent Bridget Neese. School officials hired contractors to begin the work of remediating the black mold and asbestos and determining if there was any damage specifically related to the September 3rd roof failure, which was caused by a roofing contractor error. The roof of the school was being replaced as part of a $2.55 million project to rewrap the building envelope and replace HVAC equipment. The school underwent a black mold insurance investigation in 2015 and two remediations for it in 2016. Ray Daigle, Director of Facilities and Operations for the Harwood Unified Union School District, said that the remediation work involves cutting out small pieces of sheetrock that reveal mold via air testing. It also includes treating wood surfaces where the mold is indicated. The discovery last week of mold in the kitchen came when he got word that there may be mold under the, quote, dish pit. Quote, "We found it there on a 2x3-foot section and on the sheetrock with trace amounts of asbestos. And the hot water heater blew up and the press relief valve dumped superheated water into the floor below," he said. Mold has been found in multiple classrooms, and earlier this week, some was found in the library as well, according to school principal Beth Peterson. Daigle said the amount of mold being removed was small, not giant wall-sized portions that people might see in hotter, more humid parts of the country. In the kitchen, however, abating the asbestos and black mold will require replacing the whole kitchen floor. Superintendent Bridget Neese said that, quote, "the kitchen was a blow." Quote, "it was not part of the renovation project and not part of the water coming in from the roof. Once the mold in the kitchen was found, the whole kitchen had to be evaluated, and now we have to phase in how to fix that," she said. As of press time, she said the plan for breakfast and lunch for Warren students is to have food prepared at Harwood Union and said kids will eat in their classrooms. Quote, "the only spaces not able to be used are the art room and the cafeteria. The air quality testing continues to be good. Yesterday, a small patch of mold was discovered in the library behind a shelf where boxes of old computer equipment were stored, and that will be remediated today. This library patch has nothing to do with the renovations or leak roofage, as far as we can tell. The new flooring will not be installed until a vacation period. I'm exploring the option and cost of having an industrial professional cleaning of the entire Warren School after all the projects are completed, she said. In response to questions from parents and community members about whether school choice could or would be reopened for parents concerned about having their child attend the school, Nice said while school choice closed for the year, the Harwood Unified Union School District has a specific policy on choice and other issues where the board can weigh in, like placement in a class or advancement to the next grade if a parent doesn't agree with the decision of the school principal and superintendent after submitting a written letter. Parents who want to appeal the decision of Nice and a building administrator would make a request from the Unified Union Board Chair for that appeal to be heard. Beyond that, and in these specific circumstances, Nice said, quote, this is a new territory for the board. The policy doesn't allow parents to make choices in the middle of the school year. Nice said that the Vermont Agency of Education relies on clearance from mold/asbestos remediation specialist for the school to open. She said the agency did not ask for or direct the district to undertake school-wide testing for mold. She said he asked for the most extensive testing possible without destruction, meaning taking the building down to the studs. She said school officials will know when it is safe for kids to return when they receive that okay from the air quality testing. Waitsfield Conservation Commission continues work on new RFP for invasives by Lisa Loomis. The Waitsfield Conservation Commission has gone back to the drawing board in collaboration with its community partners on a revised request for proposals for a knotweed treatment trial on the town-owned Austin parcel. The Austin parcel is a 5-acre piece of town-owned land on both sides of the Mad River between Mad River Massage and the LaRue Swim Hole. Conservation commissioners at a September 18th meeting discussed efforts to revise the RFP with input from Friends of the Mad River and the Mad River Path Association. Conservation Commissioner Mark Haberly reported to the board that the working group is still tuning it up to include public outreach and education for a volunteer-based solution focused on manual and mechanical removal of invasive plants on 1 acre of the 5-acre parcel. Haberly said he expected the new RFP will be ready for public discussion at the group's November 20th meeting and hoped that proposal would go out in enough time to have a contractor selected and ready to go by April. This summer, the Conservation Commission proposed and the Select Board approved a trial program for a knotweed eradication and floodplain forest restoration trial that involved manual cutting as well as the application of the herbicide Rodeo. The Conservation Commission subsequently received extensive public comment opposed to the use of herbicides on 1 acre of the 5-acre parcel and received a counterproposal from Friends of the Mad River and the Mad River Path Association, who felt it would be best to reissue the RFP that relies on a volunteer-based non-chemical solution. The original proposal was for a 2-year pilot plan to reduce knotweed, buckthorn, and honeysuckle using a combination of mowing, rodeo application to the knotweed, and planting to try to reestablish a native floodplain forest. The original proposal was for a 2-year pilot plan to reduce knotweed, buckthorn, and honeysuckle using a combination of mowing, rodeo application to the knotweed, and planting to try to reestablish a native floodplain forest. The original contract using herbicides was with Red Start Forestry and was for $6,600. The Waitsfield Town Plan calls for the Conservation Commission to work on invasives, thus the commission tried to tackle the issue this spring after having invasives on the Austin parcel on its agenda dozens of times in the past year. School Enrollment versus Capacity, The Numbers, by Lisa Loomis. At a recent retreat, members of the Harwood Unified Union School District discussed potentially redesigning the schools within the district in the coming years. As the school board considers various configurations of students at the 5 local elementary schools, 2 middle schools, and 1 high school in the district, the Valley Reporter took a look at current enrollment and design capacity for each of the schools. The 5 elementary schools include Warren Elementary School, Waitsfield Elementary School, Faiston Elementary School, Moortown Elementary School, and Thatcherbrook Primary School. The design capacity and current enrollment of the schools, which includes preschoolers and is taken from the 2017-18 annual report, is as follows. Warren Elementary School design capacity, 191 students. Current enrollment, 138 students. Waitsfield Elementary School design capacity, 185 students. Current enrollment, 108 students. Faison Elementary School design capacity, 140 students. Current enrollment, 86 students. Moortown Elementary School design capacity, 225 students. Current enrollment, 103 students. Thatcherbrook Primary School design capacity, 480 students. Current enrollment, 386. There are two middle schools for 5th through 8th grade students in the district, Crossett Brook Middle School and Harwood Union Middle School. Crossett Brook Middle School design capacity is 400 students. Current enrollment in 5th through 8th grades is 292. Harwood Union's total design capacity, middle and high school, is 862. Current enrollment in middle school is 146 and in high school is 527. The total school enrollment is 673. Send comments and questions about this article to news@valleyreporter.com. Heidi Speer resigns from HUUSD by Lisa Loomis. Faison representative Heidi Speer to the Harwood Unified Union School District has resigned from the board effective Monday, September 18th. In her letter of resignation, she explains that she is resigning because she now has a conflict of interest that prevents her from continuing to serve. Quote, the deeper answer is that sometimes a board demonstrates that it is not the venue for accountability and another route must be taken. Sadly, that is what transpired here. The recent actions of the HUUSD board that turn a blind eye to a pattern of hostile and retaliatory behavior, dishonesty, and violations of open meeting law by our superintendent and some board members are grossly negligent and clearly contrary to the interest of our communities. It is sending a signal to community members, employees, and students that bullying is tolerated here and they must turn elsewhere if they want to be treated fairly and respectfully, she continued. The Valley Reporter and HUUSD Board Vice Chair Gabe Gilman have also challenged the legality of an executive session meeting held on May 24th, alleging that the session violated Vermont's open meeting law. Asked specifically about her conflict of interest, Speer said, quote, I have some options and am still considering which is the best. What I can tell you is that I am keen to avoid any district expense. Faison's other representative to the HUUSD board, Jill Ellis, is continuing on the board. In addition to their concerns about the May 24th executive session, Ellis and Speer, in written letters to the board, said that the May 24th meeting devolved in a personal attack session on them. Board conduct is not a legal reason for an executive session meeting. The process for replacing Speer could evolve in one or two ways. Because Speer was elected by Faison voters at large, 5% of voters could petition the HUUSD for the right to elect their representative on the board via a warned election to fill that seat. HUUSD has posted a legal warning soliciting interested people to submit letters to Superintendent Bridget Neese, who will bring them to the larger board. That board would interview and appoint a representative. Will Senning, Director of Elections and Campaigns for the Vermont Secretary of State's office, said that education law in the state appears to allow the board on which the vacancy occurred to fill the vacancy unless voters petition for that right. The HUUSD Articles of Incorporation do not speak to filling vacancies, but Article 7 notes that board members must be elected, quote, by Australian ballot by the voters of the municipalities in which they reside. Faison Select Board members Ed Reed and Board Chair Jared Cadwell expressed concerns about town voters losing the ability to elect their representative to the Unified School Board via popular vote. Vermont Statute VSA 16 includes the following paragraph, which would appear to require select boards to appoint a new representative in the case of a vacancy. Quote, if the member represented a town that does not have a school board, the clerk shall immediately notify the select board of the town. Within 30 days of the receipt of that notice, the select board shall appoint a person who is otherwise eligible to serve as a director from that district to fill the vacancy until an election at a special or annual district meeting is held. That statute, however, refers to union schools and school districts and joint schools. Senning said he was unsure about the language used by Vermont's districts that have unified under Act 46, and he said that each new union district may have written specifics into its articles of incorporation. Send comments and questions about this article to news@valleyreporter.com. State Weighs In on Ronk Road by Lisa Loomis. Last spring, the town of Waitsfield started working with Ronk Road resident Kelvy Richards Wilson on what work, if any, the town would do on that Class 4A road. This summer, the town worked with Jim Ryan, Municipal Roads Program Coordinator for the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation, on an assessment of the drainage, layout, and erosion issues on that road. Ryan issued a report in August that detailed his findings. He noted what the town and Richards Wilson already knew. The road is steep and subject to washouts and rain damage. He pointed to problems with the size of the culverts, municipal ditching, pond location, etc. He recommended that the pond ditch from the pond outlet to the town ditch be stabilized and that a stone-lined ditch be installed for sections where there is steep gully erosion. Alternately, he suggested that the pond outlet or channel could be moved closer to a private driveway where it could cross the town road and outlet into a pasture. His recommendations were not available to the select board when this board discussed the project on July 24th. The road and how to maintain slash upgrade or repair it has been on multiple subsequent agendas. However, no minutes from the select boards July 31st, August 14th, August 28th, September 7th, and September 11th meetings are available. Vermont law requires that minutes in draft form be available 5 business days after public meetings are held. In the case of Richards Wilson and Ronk Road, the July 24th minutes from the select board note that she asked the board to consider an alternative road route, which the select board rejected. The board voted unanimously in favor of an agreement with Richards Wilson, which states that the owner will create a ditch with armor from the pond so the overflow drains into the field and not onto the road, and the landowner is responsible for buying all the culverts for the road. Waitsfield's obligation will be to examine and upgrade the ditches as necessary, install the culverts on the road, as well as bring in gravel to smooth the road and grade. The extent to which Waitsfield will maintain Ronk Road as a Class 4A road was part of a 2011 settlement agreement between the family and Waitsfield over an easement for a well shield around the town's municipal well on Ronk Road. The Richards family settled for a small amount of money, and the town agreed to maintain Ronk Road to at least a Class 4A standard from the intersection of Floodwoods Road to the intersection of Northfield Mountain Road. Select Board member Carrie Dolan suggested that the town seek the help of Ryan, the municipal road coordinator, working with towns to improve runoff and water quality and infrastructure. This spring, Richards Wilson said she is frustrated by the pushback she's gotten from the select board on whether the upkeep of the road is required by the 2011 settlement or whether it is at the discretion of the board. Quote, "This was the culmination of 7 years of litigation and thousands of dollars spent on both sides. We were encouraged by the town to be creative because the town didn't have a lot of money to throw at us. One thing that the Richards family felt was of high value was the elevation of the maintenance of Ronk Road to at least a Class 4A road. We were told by the town and its attorney that the town would be willing to maintain it to a Class 4A standard. We put the words, shall maintain, in paragraph 10 of the agreement," Richards Wilson said. An obituary for Mariana Beatontown. Mariana Beatontown, 90, passed away at Berlin Health and Rehabilitation Center on Friday afternoon, September 15, 2017. Born in Westfield, Massachusetts on November 3, 1926, she was the daughter of the late John and Myra Morris Beaton. On July 12, 1947, she married Cleo Town in Waterbury. Cleo predeceased Mariana on September 29, 1972. Mariana was a graduate of Waterbury High School and continued her education at the Johnson Normal School, where she received her teaching certificate. She began her career as an educator at the one-room schoolhouse on Crossett Hill, and then following her marriage, was busy as a homemaker, raising her boys, and worked as a nurse's aide for the Sutherland family at the former Colby Nursing Home. She returned to Johnson State Teachers College and received her bachelor's degree in education and was employed at Waterbury Elementary School as a third-grade teacher for over 10 years. Following, Mariana worked in housekeeping at the Vermont State Hospital in Waterbury for several years and then worked part-time at National Life Insurance Company's Hopkins House as a hostess, retiring at the age of 80. Mariana was a longtime member of the Harry N. Cutting American Legion Auxiliary Unit 59, Wesley United Methodist Church, and the Duxbury Historical Society. In her leisure time, she enjoyed traveling, especially to Maine for the simple pleasures of life, such as a fresh blueberry muffin and a coffee. Mariana is survived by her sons, Glenn Town and his wife, Resma of Duxbury, Gail Town and his wife, Peg O'Neill of Tabernash, Colorado, and Malcolm Town and his wife, Jody of Duxbury, 8 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren, her sister, Catherine Halleck of Duxbury, as well as nieces, nephews, and extended family. Mariana was predeceased by two sisters, Stella Kennedy and Myra Dow. A brother, Robert Beaton, and her longtime companion, Edward Peterson Sr. Graveside services will be held from Hope Cemetery in Waterbury on October 3rd, 2017 at 11 a.m., with a reception to follow at the Waterbury American Legion. For those who wish, memorial gifts in lieu of flowers would be appreciated to the Waterbury American Legion, P.O. Box 417, Waterbury, Vermont, 05676, or to the Duxbury Historical Society, CO Mark Morse, Treasurer, 804 Vermont Route 100, Duxbury, Vermont, 05660. Assisting the family is Perkins Parker Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Waterbury. To send online condolences, visit www.perkinsparker.com.
An obituary, Liddell Erdenson. Liddell Erdenson, 90, of Charlotte, passed away peacefully on Thursday, September 14th, 2017, at the McClure Miller V&A Respite House with her sons by her side. Liddell was born in Albany, Georgia, on July 22, 1927, the daughter of the late William D. Littlefield and Elizabeth Liddell, D.A.R. She received her master's degree in fine arts from the University of Georgia. Go Bulldogs! She was Alpha Delta Pi. On August 22, 1951, she was married in Albany, Georgia, to Air Force pilot Albert Jean Erdenson. In Liddell's 66-year marriage, her role as devoted military wife and mother entailed 7 Air Force base relocations of her growing family. She established and resettled their household in Nashville, Tennessee, Albany, Georgia, Paris, France, Homestead, Florida, Lincoln, Nebraska, Shreveport, LA, and Kinchlow, Michigan. Retirement brought her family to the state of Vermont in 1970, where she continued to raise her family, run the family Spruce's Bed and Breakfast Ski Lodge in Fayston, teach art, and volunteer for the American Red Cross. Liddell was an avid gardener, skier, reader, and American Civil War history buff. She especially enjoyed these activities in the company of her family and dear friends. Liddell is survived by her sons Paul Erdenson and his wife Tori, John Erdenson and his wife Patty, and Richard Erdenson, and by her 7 grandchildren, Dosha, Emma, Alden, Sarah, Lauren, Michael, and Christopher. She was predeceased by her husband Jean and her daughter Andis Erdenson. Visiting hours will be held on Friday, September 22, 2017, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Ready Funeral and Cremation Service South Chapel, 261 Shelburne Road, Burlington, Vermont. A massive Christian burial will be celebrated on Saturday, September 23rd at 1 p.m. in Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church, with burial to follow in Our Lady of Mount Carmel Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, donations in Liddell's memory may be made to McClure Miller V&A Respite House, 3113 Roosevelt Highway, Colchester, Vermont, 05446. To send online condolences to her family, please visit www.readyfuneral.com. New exhibit at the Madsonian by Christopher Keating. Viewers at the Madsonian Museum of Industrial Design's new exhibit will get a heavy dose of both science and art. Bill and Julie Parker are the Mad River Valley Mad Scientists from Waitsfield, and they have combined for the first time to showcase their work at the local museum. Quote, "What we're doing is somewhat on the crossover between industrial technologies and art," said Bill Parker. Parker invented the plasma globes that almost everyone most likely knows from school field trips to science museums. Electricity bounces around inside until someone places a body part on the orb. Bill invented the sculptures in light in the 1970s while he was a student at MIT. They have been placed in museums all over the world, and he has worked for Hollywood movie sets. Quote, "I make them do certain things and have a certain look," Bill said. One called Sleepless Nights is placed in the corner of an exhibit against a black backdrop and was made to mimic the glow that always persists in the night sky in the Northern Hemisphere throughout the winter. There are 2 more orbs in the room, which were made in the 1980s. He has 1 newer plasma lamp, which is a long tube, about 6 feet long, with 1 long strand of plasma running through it. Julie Parker graduated from the University of Vermont with a degree in physics. She is also an expert photographer, and she combines all of her knowledge to create holograms, six of which are hanging in the exhibit. Julie said that the holograms are kind of ancient history because she hasn't made any since 1989. To get a good look at the images and all of the colors that they hold, viewers will have to walk near and far from the glass squares and from side to side. Quote, "It's a different way of making an image and thinking about it. I started with photography and then got into holography," she said. The husband and wife have one collaborative piece on display. It's a hologram with a single line of neon curving down the center. From the side, the neon appears on a black slate, and while walking in front of the square, a colorful background appears. The exhibition opens this Friday with a reception from 5 to 7:30 p.m. and will feature a talk by the Parkers. The Madsonian is located on Bridge Street in Waitsfield. HUUSD Working Out How to Govern by Christopher Keating. Members of the Howard Unified Union School District Board are making sure that they enter this year's budget season with a single mindset. The HUUSD Board met for its first retreat on Wednesday, September 13th. The members have been meeting for just over a year, and they officially took control of the merged district on July 1st. Last year, the 14 members, currently there are 12 members due to two resignations, two from each town were sworn in and thrown almost immediately into the budgeting process. They did not know each other well, and conflicts arose throughout the fall over budget disagreements. Board members took time last Wednesday to get on the same page. Quote, "There are laws that you need to follow that you can't really mess around with, but the culture you create is up to you as board members," said Valerie Gardner, retreat facilitator. "The HUUSD board is unique," Gardner explained, "because almost every single member served on their individual town school board." Gardner said that most boards have more members with no experience, and so they come with a clean slate. Board members explained the atmosphere of their smaller boards. Quote, "Our board was pretty relaxed and loose, and then there was a time of real volatile things going on, where everybody kind of really tightened up the reins, and there was a lot of public involvement, public frustration. So we went from pretty relaxed to pretty strict, and then sort of relaxed again, knowing that the merger was going through," said Alicia Biondo, Warren representative. Most individual boards were much smaller, between 3 and 5 members, which fostered a much more laid-back atmosphere, said Gabe Gilman, the board's vice chair. Quote, "That small size lent itself to informality in the way that a 14-member board doesn't," Gilman said. Gardner showed the board an example set of board norms, which dictated how board members would interact with the public and when public comment would be placed on the agenda. Gardner said that board members needed to decide whether or not public comment is the correct time to interact with their constituents, or if members should listen and direct the public to different channels that might be more appropriate. Gardner also noted the importance of having a well-set agenda that is based on the goals that board members set for the school district. Gardner explained to the board members that it is their job to ask the community what they expect from the board and what they see as a good investment. Quote, "I think we need to do a better job making sure that the board, the administration, and the teachers communicate with the public and help everyone get on the same page about what a good return on investment looks like," said Peter Langella from Moortown. Lastly, Gardner explained that each member needs to decide how they will vote on specific items, as a representative of an individual town or as a trustee of an entire district. She said that boards that decide collectively to vote as trustees usually get along better. Each member can bring their own constituents' perspectives into the conversation, but when it comes time to vote, board members should think about the whole district, she said. Quote, "Understand that you have a responsibility to every kid now, whether they are in your town or are not in your town," Gardner said. The HUUSD will discuss the retreat, board norms, board goals, and the budget process as the Valerie Porter goes to press on September 20th. Christopher Keating. Number 9 Hill in Facetown has been slumping for a long time. members of the Select Board have hired environmental and civil engineering firm Wilcox and Barton to study the scope of work. The study being done by Wilcox and Barton will cost the town $6,900. Quote, they're going to come up with a scope of work that would include the possibility of extending the town's right-of-way into the uphill embankment, said Jared Cadwell, chair of the Fayston Select Board. The Fayston Select Board has been discussing the issue for years, said Cadwell, and they have shimmed the road many times, but it only works as a temporary fix. Cadwell explained that it might be cost-effective to find a more long-term solution. Members of the Fayston Select Board have reached out to one landowner adjacent to the road who would be affected by the change in right-of-way. Quote, it's too early to say for obvious reasons. We don't have a specific plan yet, and the affected landowner understands and is interested to know what the scope of the project might be, Cadwell said. Quote, it's not a dire situation, but it's one where we'd rather not spend $6,000 to $7,000 every other year, Cadwell added. Housing All of Sugarbush's Employees by Christopher Keating. Sugarbush is the valley's largest employer, and each winter seasonal employees struggle to find affordable housing. Sugarbush is trying to fix that. Sugarbush has created a Tenants for Turn program to incentivize local landlords and property owners to rent their properties to Sugarbush employees. Anne Marie Todd, Sugarbush's Director of Resources, says that the resort hires between 750 and 800 employees each winter, and she keeps a list of all the seasonal workers who are looking for housing. Todd said that Sugarbush would play matchmaker for their employees. Through the program, participating landlords, as well as homeowners and tenants with an extra room, will be able to choose from one of three incentives: a $100 premium ski pass to Sugarbush, 10 vouchers for day passes at Sugarbush, or a family membership to the Sugarbush Health and Recreation Center. Quote, the idea is to find affordable rent for our employees. So basically, a landlord sets the rent, but if they want to participate in the program, we have to let them know that most of our seasonal employees can afford $500 to $600 a month rent. Other programs like this one have set specific rates that had to be met, but Todd said Sugarbush would rather let the landlords and the tenants work it out themselves. Quote, we just said affordable rent, because depending on the size of the space, there might be a very large one bedroom that two people could put twin beds in, and while maybe it's a lot for one person, for two people who might want to split it, it would be affordable, Todd said. Programs that offer incentives for housing originated at Stevens Pass in Washington. Then the same person that started the program at Stevens Pass brought it to Mount Hood Meadows, Oregon. In the past, Sugarbush capitalized on students and young skiers working in return for free passes. Quote, I would say every ski resort these days is struggling just because of the nature. A number of years ago, we had lots of college kids who wanted to work because they could earn a free pass. And in the last couple of years, with the cost of college passes coming way down, there's really not that many kids, Todd said. Many seasonal employees come from neighboring states, and Todd wants to ensure that they have a place to stay. Additionally, Sugarbush doesn't want to burden its employees with an overly long commute because snowstorms could cause issues. Last season, some seasonal employees ended up renting Sugarbush properties, like foreign employees on J-1 visas do. Quote, last year we ended up renting two properties ourselves for our J-1 students, and some of our seasonal employees did live in the property also. And we're doing that again this year, but we know that we have more J-1 students coming, Todd explained. She said that the success of these incentive programs relies on the locale. There's plenty of housing stock in the valley. Todd just hopes that some owners will offer their rooms in exchange for subsidized skiing. HUUSD students start strong, finish poorly in testing, by Christopher Keating. Students in the Harwood Unified Union School District test higher than the state average until they get to high school. The results from the 2016-2017 Smarter Balanced Assessments were released last Wednesday, September 13th. This is the third year that students throughout the state have participated in the assessments. The tests measure students' proficiency in two categories, language arts and mathematics. In mathematics, more HUUSD students scored proficient or above compared to the state score in grades 3 through 8. 62% of third graders in the district scored at least proficient, compared to only 52% of third graders statewide. In grade 8, the margin is much slimmer. 43% of district 8th graders scored proficient, compared to 41% statewide. In grade 11, however, just 25% of HUUSD students tested proficient in mathematics, 12 percentage points below the state average at 37%. A similar trend can be seen in the language arts results. HUUSD students start 11 percentage points above the state average, 49, with 60% of the district students testing proficient. Although in 8th grade and grade 11, junior year in high school, HUUSD students test 4 to 5 percentage points below average at 51 and 54% respectively. Sumac, Food for Those Who Stay, by Anne B. Day. This summer, some areas have been too wet, others too dry. Most everywhere, temperatures have been hot and humidity high. Whatever the weather, the staghorn sumac has flourished. Some of the clusters of fuzzy red fruit are twice as big as in other years. Sumacs grow in open or partially open areas and will die off when shaded out by larger trees. We see them along highways, in wet areas and sunny open meadows, fence rows, and stream banks. The sumacs belong to the cashew family, Anacardinaceous, native to temperate and subtropical zones. There are about 15 species of sumac in the United States. The staghorn or velvet sumac, which can grow up to 30 feet, is named for the dense and velvety covering on new twigs. Its fall foliage is orange-red to purple. The smoother scarlet sumac, native to the eastern and central United States, is a less common species. It grows to a height of 20 feet with an open, flattened crown and a few stout spreading branches. A cultivated variety has much dissected fern-like leaves seen at the edges of gardens. The smaller sumacs are the shining winged or dwarf sumac and the lemon or fragrance sumac. The former is often grown for its shiny leaves, the leafless of which are connected by the ribs along the axis and showy reddish fruits. The fragrant sumac has three parted leaves, scented when bruised. It forms a dense low shrub useful in landscaping. The Sicilian sumac from the Mediterranean region is cultivated as a source of tannin in southern Italy. Sumacs have been used as sources of dye, medicines, and beverages, and the dried fruits of some species are used as spice in Middle Eastern cuisine. The plants are also grown as soil binders and cover plants. The sumacs grown for landscape use display a graceful habit, spectacular fall color, or colorful fruit clusters. Poison sumac has a different genus and is a deciduous shrub or tree with an open form. It reaches about 20 feet in height, smaller than the staghorn sumac. The compound leaves consist of 7 to 13 oval leaflets with smooth margins. Young leaves are often bright orange. The leaves mature to a deep glossy green and turn orange-red before they drop in the autumn. The small yellow-green flowers are borne in loose hanging clusters. Unlike the upright fuzzy reddish fruit clusters of true sumacs, look for whitish waxy drupes that droop loosely from its stalks. The fact is, the plants aren't really poisonous. Poison ivy, poison oak, and poison sumac grow in wooded and marshy areas throughout North America. They have a sticky, long-lasting oil called urushiol that causes an itchy, blistering rash after it touches your skin and can leave the oil behind on your skin. Some people are more susceptible than others. Poison ivy and poison oak grow as vines or shrubs. Poison sumac is a shrub or a tree. Sumacs are not a choice or preferred food for wildlife, yet they are important as winter sustenance for many species in the east and prairie regions. The bright red clusters of fuzzy fruit ripening in the fall remain on the plants far into winter and sometimes provide food for early arriving robins, starlings, and others. It has been found that the fruits are a good source of vitamin A. When a combination of 50% sumac seeds and other high caloric feedstuffs was supplied to bobwhite quails, the birds thrived and gained weight. Many of our overwintering songbirds, and there are more and more who do stay in the area, rely on sumac as a winter food. Sometimes game birds will remain near a copse of sumac until the supply of fruit is exhausted. In addition, rabbits and hooved browsers feed on the bark and fruit of these plants. In fall, the sumacs are bursting with seeds for wintering wildlife, as well as providing beauty along the highways and wetlands with brilliant leaves and fruits. Sometimes these plants grow where we do not want them, but they do attract our wild friends. And on a cold day in January, you can gather the dried clusters and steep sumac tea.
Explore climate change resilience with Friends of the Mad River. Quote, from severe rainstorms to fluctuating temperatures, climate change is already impacting Vermont and the Mad River Valley. Residents and communities need to act now in order to protect property and our way of life. That's the word from Corey Miller, Executive Director of Friends of the Mad River, the community organization that has spearheaded the five-town Ridge to River Task Force. The Mad River Valley has already taken great strides towards resilience, but there are many quick and easy ways to better adapt to changing weather patterns, and the five-town Ridge to River Task Force wants to help, she added. The two-year-old Ridge to River Alliance of local leaders is hosting Climate of Change, a Mad River Valley community forum on Wednesday, October 11th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Pavilion at LaRue Farm in Waitsfield. All are invited to attend this free event, which will include a critical look at the climate-related challenges facing the Valley, as well as solutions and resources to an opportunity to socialize and visit with neighbors. Meteorologist Roger Hill of Wuthering Heights will offer a keynote address on weathering climate and extreme weather. Afterward, Ridge to River members will share what they've learned about a changing Mad River Valley landscape and how towns and residents can protect themselves and their property. Attendees can enjoy free American flatbread and a cash bar while exploring a, quote, resource fair. Ridge to River members, other neighbors, and regional organizations will showcase successful resilience strategies and offer free resources to help people reduce vulnerabilities on their properties, while also helping improve water quality and the health of the Mad River watershed. Quote, in the last few years, we've seen storms and stormwater runoff cause extensive damage to roads, rivers, and private properties in the Mad River Valley. We've also seen how simple projects can prevent that damage and save residents and communities thousands of dollars over the long term. Ridge to River wants to share those solutions widely so that we can protect our pocketbooks and our watershed, Miller said. The Ridge to River initiative formed in 2015 in response to this growing awareness of the role that runoff from storms plays in causing damaging flood events and in polluting the Mad River watershed. Ridge to River is led by a task force whose members include representatives of boards, commissions, and community groups from Duxbury-Faiston, Moortown, Waitsfield, and Warren. Over the past 2 years, the task force has focused on developing new tools and resources to support town boards and commissions, road crews, homeowners, and trail users as they work to manage stormwater and increase resilience. Ridge to River is a five-town coalition working toward clean water and flood resilience in Vermont's Mad River Valley. It is a project of Friends of the Mad River with support from the Mad River Valley Planning District and Central Vermont Regional Planning Commission. Ridge to River is funded in part by the High Meadows Fund and Lake Champlain Basin Program. Learn more at www.ridgetoriver.org. People are asked to RSVP by October 1st on Facebook or to friends@madriver.com or call 496-9127 for the Climate of Change Forum to help organizers plan appropriately.